Welcome to Madlit Musings, the podcast where we dive into the minds of authors, exploring the profound realms of faith, social issues, and the delightful world of entertainment. I'm your host, Jamie Jill Wright, and on this literary journey, you never quite know what you're going to get. Hey there, Madlit enthusiasts. Our podcast is sponsored by the esteemed Baker Publishing Group. Whether you're into heartwarming romance, gripping suspense, or deep dives into matters of faith and society, Baker Publishing Group has it all. With Revell and Bethany House Publishers under their umbrella, they bring you a diverse array of books that will captivate your mind and stir your soul. Check out all of their line at www.bakerbookhouse.com. Hello, friends of Madlit Musings podcast. It's Jamie Jill Wright today, and we have Sarah Sundin back with us. Hello, Sarah.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yes, I love having you on the show because we always have such interesting conversations. And I think part of it's because of the genre that you write in. It's just intriguing. But
World War II. Great questions.
Well, I don't know. World War II fiction is just so intriguing, and there's so many layers and elements to it.
Yeah, so, it certainly are.
Yeah. So you have a book that is releasing February 6th, and it's called Embers in the London Sky. There's the
book
cover.
Yet, by the time this comes out, I'm sure the books will be out there, but there's a pretty cover.
It's a gorgeous cover. Yeah. There's so much in that cover too. I mean, I was literally staring at it the other day, and I was trying to think what it was, because every time I saw the cover, I don't even know how to describe it, and I'm a writer, but it was like this little hitch in my emotion, if that makes sense. Like, I'll see lots of covers and go, oh wow, that's gorgeous or whatever, but this one hitched my emotion. I was trying to figure out what it was, and I figured out, I think it's because you have this destruction in the back and the sparks kind of in the air, and there's a child.
Yeah.
I think it's the child, because it got that mom part of me where I was just like, I want to jump through and just pull him to safety.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really kind of the heart of this book too, is the search for, she's searching for her child in the Blitz. And, you know, how that tugged at my heart as a mom and a new grandma and children in peril. And that was going on during the Blitz. Even with the evacuations, there were a lot of children who were still in London experiencing the bombings. So there was that's actually a theme that keeps coming up during the story, is, you know, these children who had to deal with things, even those who were evacuated, were not living at home. They weren't in with their families. And some of them were in great situations with families that really cared for them and, you know, lots of fun and living in the country excitement. And some were with families who cared nothing for them. Some were, obviously you do that type of situation. Some were abusive. Some were just cruel, like, you know, using them as slave labor, that type of thing. So the children's experience is varied. And so the heroine in the book ends up working for the Ministry of Health, which was responsible for the evacuation. So she just takes on a project in her search for her son. She takes on this project of going out to the country and interviewing children, interviewing the foster parents and the billeting officers to get an idea of what was going on. So she can, and she's kind of stunned by what's going on. And so just exploring what was, so even those who weren't in the city weren't necessarily having a great time. So for to be a child in England during the war was very difficult, no matter where you were.
It had to have been pretty traumatic. It brings to mind, I mean, it's silly, but it brings to mind the Chronicles of Narnia, because you read about the three poor Pevensey siblings, and they're going off to this house. And I don't know if a lot of people realize that was during the Blitz, that these kids at the beginning of Narnia are being sent to this old man's house.
Yeah.
You know, they discover the wardrobe, and that is a whole other story. But I've always thought about that when I think about the Blitz, is those kids leaving the train station to go into the country.
I think that's one thing that the most recent movie showed, you know, they had a little prequel that wasn't in the book with them living through the Blitz. And I think that give that historical context for the modern reader. It's like, this is why they were doing this, because staying in at home with their loving parents was not safe.
Right.
And so they were going to this house with this man who seemed indifferent, and they're forced to make up their own games and explore and, you know, search for connection. And they had, all they had was each other, it seems. So, yeah, I think that's I think it really shows some of the, what was going on, at least for one family in a very, very typical situation.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So tell us a little bit. I'm looking at the back cover copy. We have your heroine who is, escapes to London from the Netherlands, which I thought was an interesting, now, why would she have escaped from the Netherlands to London? Tell me the history there, because I'm lost on that one.
She has an aunt, a Dutch aunt, who married an Englishman.
Okay.
And so, and lives in England. And she and her cousins used to go over to England when she was growing up for the summers. And then she ended up going to school there. Most of her cousins did. Her cousins will be in the next couple books in this Not Quite a Series.
Oh, okay. And, not quite. So, I like that. Not quite a series.
Yeah, exactly. Because I'm not even sure if they're going to meet each other during the other books, but they are, just because of the situations of their stories, they may not be to meet each other. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so Aleida comes to the Netherlands. She wants to escape. For her original plan is she's in an abusive marriage.
Okay.
And she plans to take her little 3-year-old son and escape to England to get away from her husband. And the day she's planning to do it is the day the Germans invade.
Oh.
And her husband says, "We are leaving. You have a family in the Netherlands, don't you? Get in the car. We're going." Mm-hmm. And now she's terrified because now she's, how can she, now she can't escape from her husband.
Right.
And as they're on the road, he has no love for his little boy. Little Teo was born missing the fingers on his hand.
Okay.
And so he sees him as a freak. This is partly my own experience. My oldest son, my little boy of 30, was born missing his left. Yes.
He's always your little boy. It doesn't matter how old.
I know. He has a beard. He has his own baby, but he's my little boy. But he was born missing his arm below the elbow. So, but of course we all adored him. And, you know, he was never treated. He's adapted very well. But I know with a lot of families with children's disabilities, sometimes there can be lots of problems. And especially if you have a man who has that controlling, abusive nature, like, who'd you sleep with to get, you know, the situation? Mm-hmm. So anyway, he does not like his son. And so one night they're sleeping on the road and he takes the little boy and throws them into a car, a family bound for London. And tells Aleida, we'll meet them up again in London.
Oh my
gosh. And that was based on something that happened historically. When I was researching for Until Leaves Fall in Paris, which was set obviously in Paris during the war, and I was reading about the invasion. Now, you've seen the pictures where there are literally millions of refugees on the road trying to escape from the Germans, and the planes are strafing. These families were panicking, and most of these people were on foot. And some of them saw a car and said to themselves, "My child stands a better chance with strangers in a car, you know, can get further away than we will on foot." And they would throw their children into cars, but then they would arrive in Lisbon, or they would end up back at their homes after everything settled down, and they couldn't find their children. And the newspapers in France were coated with these classified ads of people trying to find their children. And devastating, broke my heart.
Oh my gosh.
And what if you have a child? So that's why Teo is only 3 years old. He's old enough to say his first name, but not his last name. He probably can't say his parents' names. And so, you know, he's old enough to remember mommy, but maybe not, doesn't know mommy's name.
Right.
And so so that's when I came up with the idea of Aleida losing her son. And all she knows is that it's a family bound for England. And her husband is killed the next day. And she goes to England alone, trying to find her son. So, but while she's there, she meets Hugh Collingwood, who is a BBC radio correspondent. And she thinks that he can help her find her son. Mm-hmm. So that's how they meet. And he's, meanwhile, he's reporting on the Blitz and trying to, make a name for himself and all that stuff. So,
well, now my heart really itches when I see that cover. I'm remembering my little boy when he was three. I'm like, every mama bear instinct in me raises. And you think about the fact that your mama bear instinct raises to protect the child, and yet that might have been the best way to protect the child. And it's so contradictory to, heart-wrenching.
Exactly. And that's something that Elaida wrestles with throughout the whole story is, when she finds her son, is it best to take him back? Does he remember? What if he doesn't remember her? Is it best to uproot him again? I mean, she starts to have all these thoughts about is she acting for herself out of her desire to have her child with her, or in the best interest of the child? And it's she faces this really heart-wrenching situation that no parent should ever have to face of, searching for her child and not having any idea where he might be, or even if he's alive, of course.
Alive, right.
And so, and she's an anxious personality anyway. She's we would probably now say she has OCD. She lines things up. She counts things. She repeats. She has all these little rituals she does to keep her life in control. And now her life is completely out of control. And it's a hard situation for her. And my heart just broke for her the entire story.
No one can ever accuse you of being nice to your characters. I'm just going to say that, you know? I mean, granted, you're writing during World War II, so there's a little bit of grace I can give you on that. But
falling.
Wow.
Yeah, no.
Oh, man. Okay, so the Netherlands would have been Holland.
Mm-hmm.
Is Holland pretty much the Netherlands? Netherlands.
We call it Holland, but technically Holland is a province within the Netherlands.
Okay.
We use it interchangeably, but the Dutch don't like that. So they call it the Netherlands.
The Netherlands. Okay. So there's the Netherlands. And then I'm equating. This is what my brain does. I think of World War II and then I kind of try and position things. So that would have been where Corrie ten Boom and her family were hiding the Jewish people in their home. And that's where Elaida was running from as someone from the Netherlands to London. Okay.
So she never had to experience life under the Nazis.
Okay.
Because she got out in time, but she did experience the chaos of the invasion and the danger of the invasion.
Yeah. So well, you just think about the displacement of families. And I don't mean in any form or shape want to diminish what happened with the Jewish community, but you also don't always think about how it also affected the non-Jewish communities as well in that area.
Loss of homes due to bombing, all sorts of things. People just, the father's away. What happens to the mother? And then obviously, as the war progressed, people fleeing from their homes. So after the war, there were tens of millions of people in these displaced persons camps. A lot of them were concentration camp prisoners who were free, but they had nowhere to go to, and people who lost their homes due to bombing or just due to war and lost their families. It was just chaos in Europe after the war, just absolute chaos.
Okay, so let's switch over. We have Hugh Collingwood. He's the BBC radio correspondent, which throws in a whole other angle from the standpoint that you always hear those reels and those things like, this is the BBC, So tell me a little bit about that, because that was probably maybe a more fun and entertaining part to research.
It was.
Okay.
It was a lot of fun. So learning about the BBC, and that was partly because when I wrote When Twilight Breaks, that the heroine in that was a newspaper correspondent in in Munich before the war in 1938. And I found the journalistic community so fascinating. I mean, they're so witty and this high-paced back and forth banter, and this interesting community of intense competition and yet support.
Okay.
So very interesting But all these extremely intelligent, well, well-read people who knew what was going on. And so I kind of wanted to dip my toes back in that community again. And so I, when my publisher and I decided to set, I had a few ideas of where I wanted, I had my story for Aleda, but I wasn't quite sure where it was going to be. Okay. And when we, my editor says, well, you have to set one during the Blitz. Like, yeah, that'd be kind of fun. And then like, oh, I could do a BBC correspondent. So, and of course, radio, and I didn't really think about it. We, you know, we look about radio, it's old fashioned. It was in, you know, the World War II, but World War I, there was no radio. It really developed in the 20s. So in the 30s, I know.
I mean, not I saying that I doubted you, but I'm like, it never dawned on me. Like,
I don't know how many, I've written quite a few World War II books. And this is the first time I'm like, oh, yeah, this is the first war where radio was important. Yeah. So they were learning how to report by radio. It was a whole new thing. And before the war, the BBC, they had news readers. So more like our anchors, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
So they would read the news.
Okay.
You know, in front of the microphone in the BBC studios. And they had just pioneered outdoor, what they called outdoor broadcasts. And they mostly used them for sports. So they'd go to a horse race and they had a guy and they had to engineer an entire different type of microphone to use that would pick up his voice and some of the background noise, but not all the crowd and all that. And so the engineering behind how you do an outdoor broadcast was really very interesting. And so this was, they just started doing that in the late 30s. And so now there's the war. And the journalists, you know, the correspondents want to be out there recording, but there are technical problems with recording out in the open. There were, you know, the machines they had to use were enormous. And how do you work that out?
Right.
So there were some technical issues. There were, I'll use the word censorship as opposed, but it's not quite truly what I would call censorship. And this is another theme in the book. It's like, when is it censorship? And when is it, we want about freedom of speech and censorship is the two extremes, but what about when we need to have appropriate discretion? Mm-hmm. And so they were balancing this because at this point they had the Ministry of Information in Britain, which wanted to control what information was going out to the population. And BBC was not, it's a weird little thing where it's kind of governmental, but it's not. They have a charter with the government, but they are not controlled by the government. But in the BBC charter, there was the provision that in times of war, the Ministry of Information could take over the BBC and control it.
Okay.
And so the BBC did not want that. And so they were self-censoring. And at the beginning, they erred on the side of too much caution. And they really started to take a lot of flack for that, with people joking about, Betty knew what was going on and the BBC wasn't reporting it.
Right.
And trying to find that right balance between reporting the truth and when does reporting the truth hurt the population? Obviously, and during the war, it'd be, oh, here is a bomb falling right at the corner of Regent Square, right at Regent Square.
Right.
And the Nazis are like, so, okay, now we can adjust our navigation accordingly.
Yeah.
So you want to be so accurate that because they could pick up those radio broadcasts in Germany. So you had to be very careful that they weren't giving comfort to the enemy by providing information.
Yeah.
So they didn't have broadcasts because the way the weather flowed. Exactly. So then that would give the Germans information. Well, then we don't have to worry about a bombing raid tonight because the weather's lousy. And so, all these things that you don't think about.
Mm-mm.
So they had to be very, there was a point where they had to be very careful in the reporting not to tip off the Germans. But on the other hand, if they were like saying, yes, we didn't lose any ships. We haven't lost any ships at all. None. And yet families are getting reports that their sailors have died. Mm-hmm. So you, there gets the point of being ridiculous. So they were this constant battle, especially early in the war, 1940, 41, between the certain members of BBC, certain members of the Ministry of Information. Some people in the Ministry of Information were all, for what the BBC wanted, but there was this little back and forth. And actually what was worse was the armed forces. The armed forces really wanted very strict censorship.
Okay. Yeah.
So there was this battle, and they were actually trying to interfere directly with the BBC. So there was this very interesting interplay of governmental organizations and this semi-governmental, and it was the only radio broadcasting company in Britain.
Okay.
By charter, it's the only one. Okay. In America, we have CBS, we had BBC, we had NBC, we had Mutual. They were all, and all these local ones that were independent. Mm-hmm. So it was a different situation. But in Britain, there's only one at the time. Yeah. They had a couple of channels, what we call channels, but they didn't have, they only had one organization. So really interesting to, and then just reading up about the real fun pop culture parts that, the shows that were popular and the songs that were popular, and just the little catchphrases they had that were popular with the BBC. And so just, it was kind of fun diving into that more lighthearted pop culture part of it, but still with the heaviness of how do we balance freedom of speech versus morale versus keeping the public safe.
Yeah.
So it's kind of fun. And so I had my Hugh and his reporter friends have lots of fun conversations about this stuff. And Elena's watching kind of back and forth like a tennis game, and she loves it.
Oh my goodness, what's going on? Well, and you think about it too, like if with radio, I mean, really it's new technology too. So it's not like, it's like you said, it's not like all of this had been standardized and there was a process.
Exactly.
Oh man.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And
they,
I'm thinking
were making
about,
it up as they go.
Yeah. Yeah. And you would want to do weather reports because that helps the German pilots know what the wind direction was. And, oh my goodness.
But by the time they hit D-Day, they had lots of reporters on the ground landing with the troops. And by the time that time, BBC had developed a small recording device about the size of a shoebox, that type of thing, that the men, they jumped from airplanes carrying this thing, recorded, and were able to send their recorded broadcasts back to England. Now they couldn't transmit it like we would. They had to take the disc and send it
messenger or whatever
back to
messenger.
England. So it was a bit delayed by a couple of days or longer.
Yeah.
But still, they had the sounds of these men on the beaches of Normandy. And those are amazing to listen to. But by that, I mean, it started off, they had the equipment in a van, and by the time of D-Day, they had it down to the size of a suitcase.
Wow.
So just incredible technological advances during the war. And he was kind of in the early to middle phase. It's 1940, 1941 at the time of the story.
That's
so
awesome.
He still has the van, but he's battling for the right to use it because his boss is kind of on his case.
Oh my gosh, this sounds so fun. This sounds so fun. All right. So we started with heartbreak. We're ending with fun. That's okay. I can deal with that. But so the book is called Embers in the London Sky. It's by Sarah Sumden. It is released on February 6th. And you can probably do pre-orders now when you're listening to this podcast because it won't have been released yet. So you can head over to bakerbookhouse.com, get it for 40% off and free shipping and all that fun stuff. So is there anything else listeners should know, or where should they find more about you and your books?
Well, my website is sarahsumden.com, and I have links there to all my social media. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, whatever we're calling it by the time this podcast comes out. I joined Threads. I'm not doing much there.
Right.
So, I need help.
You're
have
around.
A there, but...
You're around. We can find you somewhere.
Yeah. I'm all over.
Oh, man. Well, this was fun. I look forward to reading it. And readers, if you read it, leave a review. Reviews are so helpful for authors. And this is one you definitely want to add to your to be read, because Booklist has already given it a star review, which means it's a must read watch for it when it comes out. So good to have you with us today, Sarah. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you again.
Thank you for joining Mad Lit Musings, where every conversation is a journey and every book is a new adventure. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast player or check us out on YouTube, and let's explore the fascinating intersection of faith, society, and storytelling together.